You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line are Howard N. McLaughlin, Jr. and Raymond Z. Miller. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much for having us this morning. I appreciate that.
Gentlemen, you have put out a book called From the Volcano to the Gorge, Getting the Job Done on Iwo Jima. And I want to get into that in great detail in a bit. But before we do that, for the benefit of the listeners, can you explain to them a little bit about your lives leading up to Iwo Jima, where you're from, when you were born, what you did prior to enlisting? Howard, let's start with you.
All right. I was born in Yreka, California, which is about as close as you can get to Oregon without being there. I was raised partially in Redding, and the rest of the time was in Sacramento. I went from Sacramento, I went into the service, and there I was sent to school at what was called Flagstaff Teachers College. It's now the University of Northern Arizona.
Right, NAU.
Right. Went from there to the fleet, and from the fleet across the ocean to all these wonderful places you're supposed to be able to travel to.
Right. I'm going to hazard a guess at your birthday just from putting together some things in your part of the book. Were you born on December 9th, 1925?
That is correct.
Because I read something in the book where it said you turned 16 2 days after Pearl Harbor, I think.
Right, okay. Correct.
And prior to enlisting, obviously you were, as I just said, 16 years old. You were just a young man. Did you just have a regular American childhood growing up in California?
Well, I don't know what you call it, regular. At that time, we had ROTC programs, which they don't have too many of anymore. I was in ROTC. Before I finally graduated, I was a major. I was a battalion commander. That was my prior military experience.
How about pre-military, growing up in California? You have brothers or sisters?
I have a brother, and my father tried to get us out in all the good things that there are around here besides what you get in the Boy Scouts. I got a lot of outdoor things besides working. At that time, you worked. Nobody gave you anything.
Right.
To me, it was normal. You worked after school. You worked on weekends and whatnot. If you wanted money to go to the show, you worked. Nobody came and said, here's a quarter for you to go to the movies or anything like that.
Right. And, of course, you were born in 1925, and you were just 3, 4, 5 years old when the stock market crashed and the Great Depression set in. Do you have any memories of that?
Oh, I have a lot of memories of it. Not, of course, of the stock market. None of that meant anything to me.
Right.
But by the time we got to 1932, 33, along in there, we were into the Depression. Yes, I got a lot of that. We were lucky, our family. My father was in civil service. So consequently, we got a check every month. That made a big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. You had said you were in ROTC, which is, I guess, the Reserve Officer Training Candidate School, which, as you said, they don't have too much of that anymore.
Right. This was something they had in high school. And we had three high schools in town, and all three high schools each had a battalion of their own. And then we marched against each other, and we played games against each other, and anything you can think of to keep up that military spirit type of thing. And of course, at that time, until the last year of it, we had no inkling of a war, except in Europe.
Right. What do you think attracted you to ROTC?
Let's say I was lazy. I didn't want to get into sports. I like football the best, but I sure as hell I didn't get beat around all the time.
Right.
As a lineman.
So really it wasn't that you selected it because you were in love with the military. You did because it was maybe a second or third choice.
Well, my love for the military was, as everybody mainly was then, was becoming a fighter pilot. That was the thing that everybody was trying for. One guy I know of that made it, he lives over in Redding. I still see him occasionally, but he became a B-51 pilot. And the rest of us all went to the diversity of where we ended up. By the time that I graduated, I guess there was maybe 200 in our graduating class. In our high school, there was probably well over half of the boys were already enlisted in some branch of the service by the time we graduated in June of 1943.
Mm-hmm. And you had gone into San Diego MCRD, which is the Marine Corps Recruit Training Depot, because I was actually across the fence from where you guys both trained in the Navy.
We could throw sandballs at you,
And I heard stories about some of the Navy guys wanting to get out of boot camp and jumping over the fence and ending up with the Marines.
March the 15th of 1943, I signed my enlistment papers at the 12th Naval District Station in San Francisco. It was a delayed enlistment in that I was to graduate from high school, and then I would go into service, which I went in on active duty then on the 1st of July.
Right. And I think from reading in the book that that date was significant a couple of years later, 2 years later, because wasn't that the date that Iwo Jima was declared cured?
That's right. I hadn't thought of it that way.
Were you in training to become an officer?
Theoretically, it was the object of the game. And you were the same in this officer's candidate school that you were even in boot camp or any place like that. You were not allowed outside radios, information, anything of that kind. And so that when it came time to the first quarter was the 1st of November, I think. And they went through everything and they hassled up about at least half of all of the Marines and sailors in these boot camps around the country. I think there was pretty close to 800 Marines showed up in about 3 or 4 days there at San Diego, and we all had the pre-officer candidate training, I guess. Mm-hmm. But the only thing we really had was tailored uniforms, and we had all our insignias and knew how to say yes, sir, and no, sir. And everybody had ROTC, so we knew how to march, and all in all, it made our boot camp was quite easy.
Mm-hmm. And something else I wanted to mention, when you were, as you said, in Flagstaff, Arizona, which is now one of the three big universities out in Arizona, NAU, Northern Arizona University, that's where you met Helen.
Right. That was my wife. I met her before I went overseas. I married her right after we came back from overseas, and she died 60 years and 8 months later.
Right. Sorry about that. Yeah, I read that you kept in very close contact with her for the next 30 months after overseas.
Right.
Left. And one last thing I wanted to ask you. When you heard the news about Pearl Harbor, what was your initial reaction?
It's sort of a combination of joy. In other words, here were kids that were never going to see it. All of a sudden, we're going to get a chance to go to war. You know, we were working on model airplanes at that time. We were over in the park near the house, and some of the other kids stopped by. About 4 or 5 of us were flying model airplanes, working on them, trying to get them together for a contest coming up in a couple of weeks. So they stopped by and told us about it. I don't know. At 16, that stuff, it can't get through to you. It's too much. It's even too much later on. But anyway,
right.
At that age, it was really astounding, breathtaking.
Mm.
I can't say anything about that any more than I can tell you about what happened when the bomb was dropped in Japan. They called us together. They told us what had happened. We were dismissed for the day. We went back. It was about 10, 11 o'clock in the morning. We went back to our tents and laid down for the rest of the day and sat there and laid there and tried to fathom out what was going on in our lives. None of the jumping up and down and parades or anything like that.
When you heard about Pearl Harbor, you wanted to get into the fight, I guess, right?
Yeah, that was the object. Oh, yeah. 16, 17, hey. I can see why the military wants that age group in there.
Sure. You're in California right now, right, Howard?
I'm in Eureka, or on the coast, and down about 40 miles from the Oregon border.
Okay.
And Wairika, where I was born, is about 30 miles closer than that to the Oregon border, only it's in the Central Valley. So we've got to go over a big hump of hills here to get into this valley that's where Wairika, and actually four places, I assume, back east, were next door to each other.
Right. Kind of like going from Tucson to Phoenix or Phoenix to Flagstaff, I guess.
Yeah, right. I get off on another story here that I run into when I went to Nagasaki after the war was over, and I was transferred to this unit. One of the things that I was doing when I needed parts for the engineer battalion that I was in was to go into Nagasaki, and I stop and pick up the mail. Okay, when you pick up the mail, the guy I run into, hey, did you see this guy over here? Well, it turns out he's from California. Of course, now he's from California, he's from Eureka, and I'm from La Jolla, which is just outside San Diego.
I know it well.
Okay, and so here's all these people thought that we lived just across the street from each other. You know? I mean, they couldn't understand it, but anyway.
Your history is a little easy. I mean, you were from California, you're still living there, but I think, Ray, yours is a little different, right?
Yeah, I got around a little bit more.
Where were you born?
I was born in Chicago.
When's your birth date, if you don't mind me asking?
16th of March.
24?
1924. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You guys are pretty close in age. And
yep.
Ray, if you could, for the benefit of the listeners, give them a little background about yourself in the same framework that Howard did.
Okay. My folks were wonderful folks. I was the only child, and they loved me very much. And my mother was talented in her imagination and in music. And my father was very talented in his own personal organization. We'd always been workers in the family. And my father worked at several different jobs trying to find out what was going on out there. But he was involved in a lot of athletics. He actually played professional basketball.
Wow.
A long time ago, and semi-pro baseball, and taught boxing and wrestling in the Army. And so he was very athletic. My mother was very athletic. She loved the gym. She loved to play golf. And I was maybe a little bit of a disappointment. My father would have liked it if I'd been on the football team. I did play in the band. I was quite musical. We moved to Wisconsin when I was 9 months old, and they hadn't even asked my permission to go, so they just picked me up. And my father had a job in Wisconsin, and I was raised there in Oshkosh.
Oh, sure.
I was there for 20 years or so. Mm-hmm. I had a very good time in school. I enjoyed learning. I enjoyed the other people. I did a fair amount of singing and dramatic work. I did some writing. I really had fun, but I learned things in school and had a lot of friends. And I'll say again, I did a lot of singing then, and I still do some singing. I enjoy that. I really enjoyed life. I had fun in high school. My father was a bit of a disciplinarian, and he didn't want to give me an allowance. And so I figured, well, I'm going to go out and get a job. And so I started doing a number of different things to make some pocket money and worked nights. And later on, when I was in high school, worked nights setting pins in the bowling alley, pick up a few bucks there, actually quite a few. You're going to take girls out, they want you to spend some money on them, so
yeah.
I worked
what's
to do
up,
that.
What's up with that? Jeez. I saw what you did in Alaska. That was pretty industrious.
I didn't have as much fun in Alaska, but I had always wanted to go to Alaska, and I, as part of another story, I think, which may be in the book, when I went to boot camp, I wound up going to San Diego just like Mac did. I signed up in Milwaukee, and they shipped us out to the West Coast. Went through boot camp there. I did a pretty good job on the rifle range, and they needed instructors on the rifle range. And I was an instructor on the rifle range at Camp Calvin B. Matthews, just outside of La Jolla. And actually, there wasn't a hell of a lot to do out there, but I remember being at the USO in town. You know, you could see girls there or little old ladies, but the opportunity for female companionship was slight. And I see on the bulletin board there that they were offering classes at the local college there for any of us servicemen that wanted to go over and take classes. And just to be able to do something different, I enjoyed my job on the rifle range. But in the evening, I'd go down there, and I was a student at a girls' school and would run into girls on the campus there. And there were very, very, very few young gentlemen around there. There's a couple old guys that were janitors or something, but it was a delight to talk with the girls. On the rifle range, there was a girl that came out. Actually, it was the commandant's daughter came out in her little pickup, in her little Ford convertible, and she and I kind of liked each other, but there was a lieutenant that liked her, and I wound up getting transferred. Got transferred to Camp Elliott to another outfit that was just terrifically boring. And I figured, I got to get out of here. So I wrote a letter to my father. My father did have some connections in the Marine Corps, and so I said, I want to get out of here. I want to go to Alaska. I'd never been to Alaska, and I guess about a week later, I got a call into the first sergeant's office, and he said, well, who the hell do you know?
Right.
He said, I got these papers with pink ribbons all over them. He said, you're leaving for Puget Sound Navy Yard in 3 days, so pack up your bag and get going. So I went up to Puget Sound Navy Yard, was there for a couple months, and then went there with a group of Marines to replace some other Marines at Kodiak, and I was up there for 15 months. That gets kind of boring, but I got there, and I saw a little bit of Alaska, and I was very pleased to come back. After being in the Marine Corps 2 years, I came back to Seattle, and I had a few bucks in my pocket, and there were the bright lights and places to go and girls and waves. I'd never seen a wave before.
Right.
And so life was better again for a while. When I was in high school, I'd never talked with my father or my mother about my life's plans. What am I going to do when I get out of high school? I'd kind of assumed that I would be going to college, and I wasn't sure why. It just so happened that in our high school, we had 6 months classes. I think that's the easiest way to put it. You were in the class of the June class or the January class. I was due to graduate in January of 42. Then the war started in 41. It was just a few days after I had heard the president speak about the bombing of Pearl Harbor and a day that will live in infamy. So I went and joined up in the Marine Corps. Actually, I never even went to my graduation, but I wound up getting a diploma anyway. I went into the Marine Corps and boot camp and the rifle range, and I did well on the rifle range and went to Alaska, came back, and then joined the 5th Marine Division. That's where I wound up down there at Oceanside and running up and down the hills and starting to learn more about what was going on. I was a company armorer, actually.
In high school, what made you go in the direction of the military? I know you said your dad was involved in the Army, but what made you go in the direction of the military?
Well,
what made you go to the Marines and not the Army?
I was one of millions with great patriotic fervor, and I wanted to get in there and do something, and because the Marines maybe had a little bit more sexy appeal or something like that, then that's what I wanted to do, and I went and I joined up with them, and I don't regret that at all. My father was disciplined. I'm not saying that he was hard on me, but he disciplined himself. He was very well organized. His job for years and years and years was a matter of organizing things, and he did that well. And I guess I learned something about organization just by osmosis, just by seeing what he was doing.
Right.
So I kind of fit into the Marine Corps pretty well, especially being in a family that's a get-the-job-done sort of family.
So when did you enlist in the Marine Corps?
I enlisted the 17th of January in 42.
Okay, so that was obviously soon after Pearl Harbor.
Yep.
That was, I guess, the precipitating factor that brought you in?
Well, I was going to get drafted anyway.
Right.
I wasn't joining up just to avoid getting drafted, but every able-bodied young man was going to wind up with a uniform, and I could see the handwriting on the wall there. And the interesting thing, too, for whatever it can mean, is I'd never talked with my folks about what I was going to do when I got out of school. School didn't scare me. I enjoyed learning things, and I had a lot of fun in school. I did lots of things and had fun. I didn't have to decide what I was going to do getting out of school. I went and joined up, and the 4 years was a million-dollar education.
Right. And you, I guess, came out of the Marine Corps as a sergeant, is that right?
That's true.
Okay. And Howard, I just want to jump back to you for a second. You were in the reserves when you got out, is that right?
Yeah, because of going to school, I had a 10-year commitment. So although I was discharged, I wasn't, if you follow what I mean.
Mm-hmm. From the volcano to the gorge, getting the job done on Iwo Jima. It's split into two parts. It's Howard's recollections and then Ray's recollections. And of course, this was just published in 2010 by Tower Publishing. And Howard, you started writing this back in 1989, is that right?
89 and 90.
Okay.
My wife was in beginning stages of Alzheimer's, and I had a girl here to keep her company and whatnot. While they watched baseball and whatnot, I sat in here on a computer and tried to put down all the things I could remember for my grandkids. And finally, I tried to rearrange them a little bit, and this sort of ended up like a book.
Right. So what motivated you to do it was for your grandkids to understand exactly what happened there, what happened to you and what happened there, right?
Well, I guess you could say that part of it was I'm proud of what I did. I wanted them to know. I can remember my father was a legionnaire. He only got to school in World War I, but I can always remember how proud he was and everybody else was. It was in the American Legion.
Mm-hmm.
That just hung over. I wanted my kids to appreciate what that meant.
Okay.
It just sort of rolled together. I put one thing down tonight and the next night something else, and then all of a sudden I remember something and I go back and with a computer I could type it in between and it would correct my spelling and hey, I was off and running. So.
Yeah, on page 198 you say here that this narrative was originally written in 1989/1990 as a history lesson for my family. It has not seen the light of day until now. And of course the approximately 200 pages here, that's just a small portion of what you wrote, right?
That is correct. That was part of one book, and I wrote three books and included all the pictures I could find that were of units I was with and places I had been and whatnot. Say roughly 600 pages of writing there to go through and try and squeeze it down to something.
Right. And Ray, how about you? When did you start writing this stuff down?
I would occasionally talk with people about some of the things that happened. In my own way, I would see something that maybe I thought was very interesting or maybe a little unusual or funny or something like that. I guess I never wanted to see things quite the way that everyone else did, looking for something new or interesting. And my mother had a lot to do with this. She sparked my curiosity and interest and fed me an awful lot of interesting stuff from literature and other interesting people, and I kind of got the bug on that. So it didn't bother me too much to relate some of my experiences. I didn't do a lot of this, but I know some fellows never want to talk about it. And I would, at times, I was visiting Mary Smith, my present roommate, and her mother would visit, and I would tell some of these experiences with her. And also, nearby is St. Joseph's College, and I worked there for a while, and I met a man by the name of Paul Selbst. He was running the master's degree program there in healthcare management, but he was musical, and we would get together every once in a while and have a little bourbon and maybe a cigar or something like that, and I would tell some of the stories that I had because he found them interesting, and he said, you know, you should tell others about this. There are people that should hear about this. So he encouraged that. So maybe 10 years ago, I started writing this, and I had written some stuff before, so the writing aspect wasn't all brand new. Like Howard, he'd written some other stuff, and that makes it easier. Actually, the publisher of Tower Publishing, Michael Lyons, is a longtime old friend of my business partner, Pete, and I went to talk to him about actually an invention I had, or an idea I had, and we got to talking about this thing, this and that, and mentioned about the writing, and I mentioned that I'd had the memoirs, and he said, I'd like to see those. And so he saw them, and then it kind of had a life of its own after that.
It's a good thing it did, because it's an amazing book that people really need to read.
I wanted to express my own views in there, and I would sometimes see things differently than others, and I'd read a lot of war stuff and the battle plan and the body count and blood and guts and all that, and I tried to see other things in the service that interested me and thought that they might interest other people also. I like good writing. I like interesting things. I've written a couple of other books, and actually right now I'm just wrapping up my first major work of fiction. I think I'm up to 591 pages. I got to the end of it about 2 weeks ago, and now I got to go back and clean up the carnage. You know how that
is. That's the story of my life. You know, I forgot to ask you, Ray, where are you at right now?
I'm in the village of Paris Hill, Maine, and I'm about 70 miles straight north of Portland.
Howard, you're out in California. Ray, you are out in Maine. Clear across the country. You guys actually have never met, right?
No, not that I know of. I would look forward to meeting him sometime, and maybe we can swing that. That would be fun, but maybe it'll happen and maybe it won't.
Right. That's interesting that you have never met. How is it that you guys actually came to know one another?
After Michael Lyons, the owner of Tower, had decided he wanted to do something with my writings, he said, it's too long for a magazine, it's too short for a book. Now, if we can get some other stories of Iwo Jima, we can make a book out of this. And so I guess I became the detective or the hound dog here to sniff it out. And I got a hold of the three different Marine Corps publications and put an article on each one saying, has your story been told? And solicited manuscripts of people that had been in Iwo Jima. And I think about a dozen and a half manuscripts came in, and Barry and Mike over there combed through those, and they chose one of those other 16 manuscripts. And I find it interesting in Howard's experiences and in mine, we have slightly different points of view on this, but I recognize in reading his stuff that there were many times I was within 100 or 200 yards of him.
Wow.
But there was no reason that we should necessarily meet.
Right.
He was in a different outfit.
That's amazing. Howard, you were in the 5th Marine Division, and you were a combat engineer. And Ray, you were in the 5th Marine Division, but you were in the 28th Marine Regiment as an armorer. Now, Howard, the 5th Marine Division, for the benefit of the listeners, how many divisions are there, and what makes up a division?
By the time that Iwo Jima ended, there were 6 Marine Divisions. Each one has approximately 20,000 men in it. Divisions 1, 2 served in several different places in combat. Others, the 5th Marine Division, only served in combat once, but we spent a little extra time there.
Okay. And you were a combat engineer. And what exactly is that?
Well, for lack of anything better to call us, because at that particular time, I was a diesel mechanic and a heavy equipment repairman, which meant motor graders and steam shovels and trucks and rock crushers and all kinds of stuff like that that you repaired to keep them in running condition. amongst the parts of the division were other separate units besides engineers. We had motor transport, we had the amphibian tractors, we had artillery, about 10 parts of it. We were only a battalion. We were not a regiment such as the 28th, which is basically 3 to 4 times the size of the outfit I was in. We were not supposed to go ashore at Iwo Jima. When we were called, we were taken completely by surprise. We went ashore. The war was going to be over in 3 days. That was 37 days before I got taken off of there. Things just didn't work out the way the military thought they were going to.
They usually don't, right?
Yeah, as I sit back and read now, yeah, that was about standard operating procedure.
Exactly. That's right. Snafu, right?
Right.
Ray, now you were also in the 5th Marine Division, but you were in the 28th Marine Regiment Armorer. What exactly is that?
Up in Alaska, we had an armory there with the Marine Barracks, and we were up there as a guard detachment, several different guard posts there, and the Japanese had already occupied a couple of the islands out on the Aleutian chain. There was a naval operating base there, an army base, and we did our job safeguarding the underground fuel tanks and everything else there in the naval part of Kodiak. We had a station armorer there, and he was due to rotate back to the States, and he left maybe 5 months before I was ready to leave or something like that. But most of this was guard duty, and things got pretty boring. I get bored easily, so I look for other things to do or other things to think about. Well, right. He was going to be leaving as armorer. He had his own little, I won't call it a shack, actually it was a Quonset hut, where he had weapons stored and have weapons spare parts or something like that. It wasn't a difficult job, but boy, I wanted something different. And the opportunity opened up, and I went to, I guess, the first sergeant. I said, you're going to be looking for an armorer out there. And he sent me to see Warrant Officer Fiore. Wonderful man. Wonderful man. He'd come up through the ranks and gotten an officer's rating. And he was in charge of that, and we got along, and so I wound up spending most of my time out there. I wasn't doing guard duty anymore. I made good coffee there. I made a lot better coffee than you get in the Navy mess hall. And my boss, the warrant officer Fiore, said, you may think that your job here is to take care of these weapons. He said, your job here is to have good coffee on all the time. There was a night motor patrol around our part of the island, and these guys would stop in 2 or 3 times during the night for coffee, and sometimes I'd shoot the breeze with them there, but it was always available. And even the Navy cooks, the back end of the mess hall wasn't too far away, but they'd be baking some bread or baking some pies, and they'd bring some bread or pies over and get some good coffee. The Navy coffee was hardly worth drinking. It tasted like iodine. This was a much better job, and I had a library on weapons and stuff like that. I learned a lot about the weapons, and this was actually sort of a specialist rating. And I came back to join the 5th Marine Division, and I had my little armory in the tent and usually had a couple of other guys that slept there. But I had some weapons there and some parts and all the stuff that you need. In training, there was very little for me to do there, except I was responsible for the other company weapons. And that doesn't mean that I'm very busy at that. I was a spare part. I would get sent away to different schools to come back and hold school on the other guys there. And in combat, I had no operation whatsoever. I was a spare part, like cooks and truck drivers, and you always need spare parts. Plug guys up into the line, do this, do that, do the other thing. And so we need spare parts, especially with all the men we lost. That's what I was. I really hardly did anything as far as the armorer was concerned in combat. I was a spare part, and I was used often.
February 19, 1945, you went to a place called Iwo Jima, which you probably had never heard of before you were there, and the Japanese pronounced it Iwo Jima, and it means Sulfur Island. Did either of you guys know about Iwo Jima before you went there?
I hadn't heard of it.
Howard?
I had never heard of it.